Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this week's episode, you may know that the United States imprisons more people than any other country in the world. But that's a relatively recent development. Over the last three decades, rates of incarceration in the U.S. have increased fivefold. 2.2 million U.S. citizens are behind bars. And race and class are major factors in who goes to prison. If current trends continue, for instance, one in three young black men will spend time behind bars. The projected rate for young white men is one in 22. Humanities Washington hosted one of its Think and Drink events to explore the reasons behind this rise in incarceration. The participants dig deeply into the history of our culture of imprisonment. They cover the impact of the drug war, issues of inequality, injustice, implicit bias, and the question of whether imprisonment even works as a punishment and deterrent. You'll hear about ways to address this systematic problem. The panel includes Murph Beeman, a staff attorney with the Institutions Project at Columbia Legal Services, and Professor Catherine Beckett, who teaches in the Department of Sociology and the Law, Societies, and Justice Program at the University of Washington. Northwest News Network managing editor Phyllis Fletcher moderated the conversation. This event took place at Naked City Brewery and Tap House on September 29, 2015. Thanks to Anna Sophia Knauf for our recording.
So we're going to go ahead and start here. My name is Zeki Barak Hamid. I'm from Humanities Washington.
Thank you.
Hey, you know who we are. Yes. So for those of you who are new and do not know who we are, we're a private, nonprofit organization that's dedicated to sparking conversation and critical thinking using story as a catalyst. We do programs statewide. Think and Drink is just one of many programs that we have that goes towards that end. Please check our website at humanities.org to figure out all the other programs that we do. I want to point your attention to this event today is part of a three-part series. The next one is October 27th, called Black and Blue, a conversation about policing and race. And November 10th, it'll come down to Seattle skin being black in a liberal city. The inspiration was that is what happened when Bernie Sanders came to town. I thought that just needs a conversation. So we're going to have it. And I'm going to stop talking right now and introduce our moderator, Phyllis Fletcher from Northwest News Network. She's the managing editor there. Take it away, Phyllis.
Thank you. Awesome. I'm so excited to introduce to you our panelists. So right here we have Catherine Beckett of the University of Washington. Catherine, what department are you in?
Department of Sociology and Law, Societies, and Justice.
Sociology and Law, Societies, and Justice. Okay, hold that mic right up and say,
okay.
I'm a professor. Awesome. Okay, very, very good. And then we have Murph Eamon here of Columbia Legal Services. What does Columbia Legal Services do?
Columbia Legal Services is a nonprofit law firm, and the project I work in is the Institutions Project, and we work for fair sentencing, humane conditions in jails and prison sinks.
Yeah.
Successful reentry for people coming out of the criminal justice system.
And point the mic right at your mouth and say, I'm a lawyer. Yeah, okay. Experts here. That's excellent. Okay, this is great. So we are here to talk tonight about mass incarceration. And, you know, when I think back on all the great editors that I've had in the news business, they always say, a story is about a person, right? It's about a person doing something for a reason. And so I want to think about that for a second and just ask you to raise your hand. Who has someone you care about who is in prison right now? And I'm raising my hand not just as an example, but I do. Who has had someone you care about have been to prison before? Okay. Who has been in a prison for any reason? I'm not going to take that question any farther, but just for any reason, if you've been in a prison. Yeah, okay. And how about a jail? Who has been in a jail for whatever reason? Okay, yeah. So this is great because we have people here who have personal experience and connectedness to this issue and knowledge, and the knowledge you bring, we're definitely, I'm going to be coming around with this microphone asking you questions. And then folks who don't have the personal experience with it, you can ask questions. It's okay. It's encouraged. If you have comments, questions, anything, we want to hear it because we're all here to talk about this same thing. So, Catherine, you got a little preview of this question I want to ask, and Murph, this will be a surprise to you, but I bet you have an answer. So I would love to know a story of a person whom you've worked with, advocated for, someone you became aware of through your work or even your personal life, who illustrates an issue about mass incarceration that you think we should be talking about.
Okay, I got one.
Okay, and remember to point it right...
Right there.
Yes, great.
Okay. So it's hard to choose because I am a volunteer with the Concerned Lifers organization, as well as it being on the faculty at UW. So I know a lot of people who will probably spend the rest of their life in prison and probably die behind bars, and their stories are incredible. So if I get more opportunities, I'll tell more. But the one I decided on 15 minutes notice to tell is about a guy named Jeff Coates. I worked with two Canadian radio journalists to tell his story recently in a documentary that aired on KUOW. And basically what happened to Jeff was he was a kid being raised out on the Kitsap Peninsula. His mother had a pretty troubled past, hooked up with and married his stepfather, who was very physically abusive, tremendously so. So Jeff was having a rough go at a very early age. He got into some trouble at school because they figured out that he was being beaten at home. They placed him in foster care, I think at age 11, if I remember correctly. He bounced around from home to home. By the time he was 14, he was in his 62nd foster care placement. And he then went into a group home where he met some other kids who were about to start high school, and they decided, well, you have to have a car if you're starting high school. So they set out to get a car by stealing one, and that included putting the driver of the car in the trunk to take him out of town so he couldn't report the car stolen. That was interpreted by the prosecutors as evidence of attempted murder, and he was sentenced at age 14 to 20 years in the adult system. So he ended up serving 17 of those 20 years. He's out now, and I'm really happy to report he's doing great. He has a girlfriend, a house, a real estate agent's license, which is a whole story in and of itself, because that's hard to do when you have a felony conviction. But he's doing great now. But I think this story really illustrates a bunch of things that are wrong with the system. First of all, we're treating 14-year-old kids as adults and putting them in adult prison. When he got to prison, they didn't know what to do with a 14-year-old, so they put him in solitary confinement. So he spent most of his 15th year in solitary confinement, which is not unusual. Vulnerable prisoners are often put in solitary confinement, quote-unquote, for their own protection. So that's a whole other issue. There's the length of his sentence. There's the fact that he none of his childhood and family issues were really taken seriously at the time of his trial. So I think his story tells so much about what's wrong with the system. I would say there has been some progress on the juvenile issue. I think there's some movement on that part of the problem of the story that I've told.
So some movement on the concept that we should maybe not put a 14-year-old in prison for 20 years. I guess we can try to take that as encouraging. Thank you for sharing that. And Murph, and not that these have to be encouraging at all. I'm just, you know, so reading into it. What do you think?
I'll talk about a woman that we met. We have a legal financial obligation and reentry clinic for people who have criminal records and have financial debt. Because of that, and also face barriers to housing and employment because of their criminal history. So this woman came in, and she was very, very upset. And her story is that she had a drug addiction. She also had been in the foster care system. She had been sexually abused, and she was arrested for possession. She was in and out of jail, and finally she needed to get out of jail to take care of her kids, so she took a plea, and she ended up in Purdy, which is the women's correctional facility, for 2 years. And she had a huge amount of debt, I think about maybe $10,000 in legal financial obligations. No employment, no way of ever paying this money back. When you're arrested, you can be fined and given all these fees and fines as punishment. So she had these fees and fines that she needed to pay. And in Washington, in certain counties, if you fail to make your payment, you can get arrested and thrown in jail because you can't pay, because you're unable to pay your debt. So she was in Seattle. There was a warrant issued for her when she finally got out of Purdy. She never got information about that. She had no job. She was on public assistance and had a a young son, and she was picked up in Seattle, taken over to Franklin County, and arrested and put in jail for a failure to pay. She finally got out, had no money for bus fare, no way to get back here, finally was able to come up with the money to get back on the back here, was arrested again for failing to pay and ended up back in jail, got out again, came back. Meanwhile, her son ended up in foster care. We were able to assist her, get a payment plan in place that was reasonable. The law says you're supposed to consider ability to pay before you lock someone up, but that has not been happening in many counties, particularly in Eastern Washington. And now, 2 years later, she has graduated from college. She has a job. She's a productive member of society. She's doing great with her son, who's well, and she's giving back and has done some volunteer work and spoke out about the work that we do and has testified before government officials about the changes that need to be made. And she's an amazing person who almost got thrown away. And so I think everybody has a story, and that's her story.
Yeah, wow, that's some story. Thank you for sharing that. So in thinking about these people and the policy issues that they represent, what is the first thing you want to work on?
I guess my answer to that has changed over the years because, you know, just when you think you've figured out what the nub of the issue is, your analysis changes or circumstance change. But right now I'm really focused on long sentences, very long sentences, because there has been some movement. We are talking about mass incarceration more than we used to, and there's a bipartisan, you know, movement to call to shift towards some kinds of reforms. But I think what's happening is that everybody's finding it easy to say, well, we should at least reform drug laws, right? And so you see some some movement there. It's not perfect, but it's getting a little better, and fewer people are going to prison for drug offenses. But what no one wants to talk about are the people who are getting the long sentences, and that if you do the math, you figure out pretty quickly you're not going to really impact mass incarceration unless you talk about the very long sentences too. So for me, that feels like just not only mathematically important, but politically important to have that conversation. What are we doing when we send people who in many cases themselves are victims of physical and sexual violence, we send them to prison for engaging in the same behaviors? And what is our theory about how that's going to work and how that's going to reduce violence? Is that really the best way to do that?
Okay, so working on long sentences. Okay, yeah, and what about Murph?
I think we need to stop locking people up, particularly if people... I mean, it's pretty basic. I just think we need to stop locking people up if they have a mental health issue, if they're drug addicted, if they have a crime of poverty, and they are not dangerous, they do not need to be locked up. And so many people that we work with, once they end up in prison, they get sicker, they get worse, and they come out, if they weren't violent, they come out more violent, or they come out more mentally ill, particularly if they're in solitary confinement. So I think we need to stop locking people up, and then if we do lock people up, it needs to be more humane. The conditions in our prisons in some places are horrible and atrocious. And I was in Walla Walla at the state penitentiary. Has anyone ever been to Walla Walla, to the state penitentiary? Yeah, anybody think it's a happy place? So we were there, and one guard was saying, God, I have 2 more weeks and I'm done. I hate this place. And then another guard who took us a different said the same thing. He's like, this place is so awful. We all hate it. And it's just so depressing to see people in cages, like human beings in cages. I was in the intensive management unit, otherwise known as the hole. And that we do that in our country is horrific to me. And if you look at Germany, if you look at France, if you look at other places, that's not happening. There's no reason we need to do that. And the guy that I was seeing, he chose to be in solitary confinement because he can't get surgery for his arthritic hip that he's had for 2 years. And he's afraid that he will be attacked because he can't run and he can't move very quickly. So he's living in a little box because he can't get health care in prison.
What are they doing in those places that they still have an incarceration system, but they're somehow doing it better than we are? What are they doing better?
I took a group of students to Amsterdam, and we were studying these issues, and we went and visited a couple prisons and jails in and around Amsterdam and Rotterdam, too. And oh my God, you don't even recognize it. So first of all, sure, there's security. It's definitely a protected environment. But once you get in, it's like, wait a minute, who are the guards and who are the inmates? You can't tell. They're wearing regular clothes. There's no strict rules. If you go to prisons in the United States, there are these periods of time called movements where the inmates can only move during these approved movement times and so forth. It's just extraordinarily regulated. Everybody has a number on their back. They can't wear their own clothes. They don't have an identity. They're a number, et cetera, et cetera. If in these prisons, what we went to in Europe, it was not a normal environment, but it almost looked like a high school gymnasium. Like there were different recreational facilities. They could choose whether they wanted to have a cellmate or not, if they preferred a private cell. So, and there were rooms with computers where they actually could do research, real research. There were facilities they could, you know, programs they could attend. It was, of course, it was controlled and restricted, but it was they weren't dehumanized in to the same extent by any means. And there were resources they could use to try to better their situation.
I want to take a big step back and ask if there was any type of event that precipitated this mass incarceration society, or was this something gradually that crept up on us?
Ronald Reagan, I think. It's kind of his fault.
So before Reagan, we didn't have a mass incarceration society?
So, and Catherine can give the... whenever I need to know a statistical answer or understand linear regression, I call Catherine.
I won't talk statistics.
So what I think happened in the 70s, we were not the lead incarcerator in the world the way we are now. And we handled crime a different way, and we went the rehabilitation route. I was just reading this book about the civil rights movement happened in the 60s. And at that same time, the Southern Democrats hated the civil rights movement. White Southern Democrats hated the civil rights movement. And the Republicans thought that this was the opportunity of a century was to capture the South, and that they could finally do that. So what they started to do was be tough on crime. And by being tough on crime, they could arrest people, they could arrest black people. And so this was their theory. This was Nixon's idea, and then Reagan perfected it. And so this was a plan. This was, as Michelle Alexander calls it, the new Jim Crow. It was thought about. It was deliberate. This was the system of what was going to happen to win over the social Democrats and maintain social control. And it's not new. We abolished slavery under the 13th Amendment, but we never said that you couldn't have a system that differentiated between people who are white and people who are black and had different kinds of systems. And so we have a whole body of laws that has preference for whites that we don't even know that we get or that we have. I could go through the 15, 20, 30 laws that are preferential based on your race. I won't do that. If someone wants to know, I can give some examples, but that's my understanding of what happened.
What is one example of one of those laws?
I would say, so let's see, the Immigration and Naturalization Act, in order to become a full U.S. citizen, so in order to be able to vote, to transfer property, to do all these things, you had to be white. And that didn't really end until the late 50s, early 60s. So that's one example. Another example is Social Security. So what are the two classes where you are unable to get Social Security or couldn't get Social Security? If you were a domestic, and who were domestics? Black women. Or if you were an agricultural worker. And so those two were excluded. The other one that's really big was a huge victory in the New Deal era was the ability to organize. And so this was tremendous. You could now collectively bargain. You had the right to collectively bargain, except for unions were allowed in the collective bargaining law, this federal law, to be all white.
If I could just add a note to that, because I think this part, what I'm about to say, actually gives us some clues about how we could think about reversing some of the things that have happened. So as Murph said, in the 60s, there was the civil rights movement, and then there was the backlash to the civil rights movement, and conservatives who were opposed to the civil rights movement sort of figured out, and there's direct quotes about this, so it's not some conspiracy theory, but the Republican strategist said, you know, we can use the crime issue as a way to talk about race without talking about race, and we can tap into those Southern Democrats who are not on board with the civil rights movement. And that was the plan. But the incarceration rate still stayed pretty flat. And I think that's the part that's confusing to some people. So you would think, oh, well, it should have started increasing back then, and it didn't. And I think the reason is that what happened in the 80s is, under the Reagan administration, Congress started passing laws that attached very significant financial incentives for states and local governments to adopt very tough policies. And that's when things really started to shift, not just in the sort of political landscape, but in the institutional level. And that's when the incarceration rate really took off.
So how much of the situation that we're in today is the drug war? And I want to give you a second to think about that. And I want to remind you all, you can have your phones out during this. It's okay. A lot of times you hear that, please turn off your phone and put it away, blah, blah, blah. You can tweet hashtag ThinkDrink, and I am going to come around and give you a chance to say things and ask questions. So start thinking about those now while we hear about how much of our current circumstance is a result of the drug war.
It's been a really important piece of what's happened, but I think that some people have the perception that if we just did away with the drug war, we would do away with the whole problem, and that is absolutely not the case. I just heard Brian Stevenson, I don't know if people have read his book, but you should. If you haven't, his book is called Just Mercy. But the statistic that he quotes is that when we had the drug war, we increased the incarceration by sixfold. Without the drug war, it would have increased by fivefold. So it's a huge piece of it, and there may be indirect ways that it's responsible for even more, but still, it's just a piece, and we have to start talking also, I do think we need to talk about drug policy, but also we need to talk about other policies where it gets trickier and more complicated emotionally, because we're talking about, in many cases, crimes that where there are victims.
Yeah, and what do you think, Murph?
I agree.
Yeah.
I don't really have anything to add.
Mega didos?
Catherine's right.
All right, yeah, cool, okay. Yeah, so I'm looking for someone who has something to say, and we have a lady right back there. Why don't you meet me halfway here, because I'm not sure I can get to you, but I want to get your question on the microphone. Thank you. Come on down. Hi there.
Hi. Brian Stevenson, who you mentioned, he says locking up the number of people that we do is a really hopeless way to run a government and a society. But what I wanted to know is there are so many more felonies than there used to be. So legislatively, I would like us to work on that, roll back the number of felonies, which deprives so many people of so many rights. Is that possible?
I don't think it's possible with the Senate we have right now, realistically speaking. But I think it's a wonderful idea, and what they did in California is they couldn't do that legislatively, so they had an initiative. And part of that initiative was taking lower-level felonies and converting them to gross misdemeanors and misdemeanors. And so I think that's a good idea. It's in our country, in our state, when we don't understand something or something is new or bad things are happening, we want to make those things illegal and put lots and lots of penalties. So DUI, cyber stalking, there's all these new crimes that we want to create, and we want to fix the solution that way rather than thinking about it in a more complex way. So I think that's a great idea. I think that there are some Class B and Class C felonies that should be misdemeanors, and there are some misdemeanors that should be infractions and not be crimes, and there are some crimes that we don't need to arrest people for. Are people familiar with the LEED program in Seattle? Yeah, so it's a great program. It's called Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, and Catherine has worked on that program and studied it. And what happens is rather than arresting the police officer when they find someone engaged in drugs or prostitution or some very low-level survival offense, is they take that person to this program and they get into either treatment or they get housing or they get the services they need, and they don't get into the criminal justice system in the first place.
I want to ask about something you were talking about before, where it sounded like you were almost describing a debtor's prison, but I thought we didn't have that here.
We do in America. We have debtor's prison for criminal debt. So it's huge, and we were talking about this earlier today. In King County alone, outstanding legal financial obligations are up to $600 million. And if you think about that, over 80% of the people in our criminal justice system are indigent. So we want to take $600 million from people who are already poor. And what this does is either people get locked up again and taken out of their neighborhoods and locked up again because they don't have the ability to pay, but it creates this tremendous wealth gap. So people who have this huge debt, they have trouble getting housing, it affects their employment, they get garnished, they can't afford to send their kids to college. This is a weight, that hopeless weight. So someone who's making $15 an hour, imagine you have a $10,000 debt at 12% interest. So the interest rate on this debt is 12%. And maybe you're doing great and you're doing better, but you're never going to escape that debt. And, yeah, I could go on and on about it, but it's a really, really huge problem.
Catherine, I know you've done qualitative research on LFOs, right, legal financial obligations. What is a story that sticks in your mind from qualitative research where you get to interview people about how a circumstance has affected them?
thinking hard. It was about 7 years ago when we did the interviews. But I think the one story I remember the most was a woman who was the custodial parent for four kids. And so she had done her time. She was working for Teach for America, I think. She was doing great, you know, in terms of getting her life back together. But she'd get these notices in the mail, and she said, you know, there's a lot of zeros on the end of this number. It was something like $1,200 or $1,500 when she was convicted. By the time she got out of prison, it had already, you know, tripled or something. And then it just keeps growing with more surcharges and interest and so forth. To the point where she, although she was living very much on the up and up for the most part, but in terms of her debt, she had to keep moving so they couldn't find her. You know, she was not going to stop if she saw a police car behind her because she could not afford to get pulled over and be put in jail for non-payment of these things with her four kids at home. So that was one of the stories that really, really hit home for me.
Now, is that the kind of thing where if you're in and somebody else can pay it on your behalf, are they even allowed to do that?
Yeah, they can do that.
Okay, so this is something that penalizes people who don't have family who can pay it.
Well, and the other thing it does is people have families that have limited means, but they scrape together everything they have, and rather than being able to save, so grandma gives them the $500 that she has in her savings account to get that person through until they can start making payments again. So it really saps families and communities who have to take what little savings they have from their families to try to pay these debts. And we talked about this again earlier today, but one of the things that people are shocked to find out is that you can be charged for your public defender after you're convicted. So if you lose and you end up getting convicted, you have to pay for those public defender fees. So the government charges you for that. And so it can be a significant amount. But if you're wealthier or your family can afford to pay for a private attorney, if they fail to pay or you fail to pay, you would never, ever have to go to prison for that. You would simply have a money judgment against you. But it doesn't work that way for poor people.
And I just want to say that's the public defender that was a given to you because you were indigent.
That's cold. Yes, this gentleman right here.
Hello. So I kind of blindly walked into this, so this is really interesting. I'm kind of sitting here thinking that this is, you know, it feels very theoretical in some ways. Like it's like scholarly, like the approach that we're sitting here learning about this. And I'm a single voter that doesn't feel like I have a lot of control in changing this. So in your opinion, what's like the low-hanging fruit that people like us sitting in here could actually do other than sharing this on Facebook and tweeting about it that could actually have an impact? Because you talk about, you know, 20 or impacting long sentences. Like, how does someone like me impact long sentences?
So
I mean, wants to
question.
Do something.
I mean, I'll let Catherine handle the long sentences because she's done a lot of work on that. I mean, I think there's one is you can write to your legislator, you can get active. I think the first thing is not to be afraid of people with criminal histories. I mean, we started trying to do work around this about 7 or 8 years ago, and we worked on trying to get an employment law passed, ban the box, and we had huge outrage from the community. It was a huge uphill battle, and it was passed in 2013. And we tried to do housing at the same time, and there was absolutely no stomach for that in city council. We couldn't do it. So we're starting to bring back housing and try to bring a law about housing in. How many are familiar with the HALA recommendations? Yeah. Few people. HALA. Okay.
HALA,
so,
right?
I was on that committee. We really pushed for HALA recommendation number 6. If you don't read any else, read that. And what it said is we need to remove the barriers to people to get into housing, whether it's private housing or subsidized housing. People need to be housed because we're all safer. Their recidivism rates go down. So what you can do is write to city council and say, I believe that criminal records should have housing. I support HALA recommendation number 6. You can write to the mayor. You can write to anybody. And that's a small, low-hanging fruit that we can all accomplish together if you're willing to take that step. The other thing that's happening is there's a resolution that was discussed in council a few weeks ago, and it's only a resolution, but it would create a stakeholders group to go through all of the fines and fees that municipal court imposes on people and analyze them and see, do we really need those? And it would go through and say, how do we fund reentry? How do we give people services, and are we doing it well or are we not doing it well? And it also says, is there a point in time in Seattle where we can say welcome home, where we will say this much time has passed and you will no longer be judged by your criminal history, and that we believe in redemption, and at some point you are done. Whether it's 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, there will come a point in Seattle where you will be free. So you can write to Councilmember Harrell, who is introducing the resolution, and the other council members, and say, I support this resolution. Please, please pass it, and let's move forward.
That's great. Yeah.
That was a long answer, sorry.
Follow up, and then I'll get this guy over here. Follow up.
Sorry. I'm not trying to dominate the mic. Is there anything non-legislative? Just... because I don't know, the odds of me writing, I'm not even a registered voter here, I just moved here.
You can still write.
Really stumbled into this tonight. Can't tell you how much I stumbled into this tonight. But so non-legislative, like what could I possibly do that could have an impact, I guess is the question.
I have an idea. I think something that is really great and transformative, not just for people on the inside, but for people on the outside, is to volunteer at a jail or a prison. There's nothing more humanizing than actually meeting people who are facing these challenges. And I think for me, and to answer the question about longs, I wish I had a really good answer to that question. I don't. But I think a piece of it is beginning to rehumanize people who have been, it's like, made invisible or monsters, one of the two, right? They're either out of sight, out of mind, or they're painted as monsters. And you go in there and you start meeting these people, and they're not. Guess what? They're human beings with, you know, many, many wonderful qualities, as well as a lot of challenges that they're facing. So, and I think the more people that see that, it's like the first step in a process toward being able to have a conversation. Well, maybe that's true. Maybe we have sent people who have done something pretty bad, but maybe we still could think about ways of addressing or recognizing the fact that they can also still change. So that would be something I would recommend.
I have a quick story about that. So
I
grew up in Western New York, and my mom still lives there. And in law school, I was doing some prison work, and the woman who had knitted with the prisoners, the women prisoners who had done that kind of work with them, was not going to do it anymore. And I said to my mom, who was depressed, my father had died, wasn't volunteering anywhere, and knits, why don't you do it? And she said, honey, they're there for a reason. And I said, well, just try it. Just go in one time. Take your needles, go in one time. I know it's scary, but just try it. And so she went, and she did it for 5 years. And she said, we don't just knit, we talk. And she's like, I wrote a bad check when you were kids, and I couldn't quite make ends meet. Like, we are not that different. So that's a great idea.
Yeah, that's nice. And I know there's a gal back there holding up a pamphlet who will accept volunteers and give you information. Yes, please talk to her. It's Kim, right? Yeah, Kim. And my man Sean over there has a project that folks can get involved in, I know. So it involves yoga. It's cool. So, yeah, and Eva, do you have a project or a question?
I agree that I've done some volunteer work at Purdy specifically, so I definitely agree that when you meet these people and communicate with them and exchange with them, you grow from that. But I also might want to suggest that you're asking what we can do. What comes to mind for me, this is more general though, is that as citizens, when we hear of somebody getting arrested and having been convicted or even having confessed to something, then we're relieved and we're done. We don't have anything else to do with it. We, as the public, we want somebody to be arrested and we don't want to think about it anymore. But sometimes some of these people are innocent, and once in a while we'll hear about somebody being exonerated. But as citizens, we need to think beyond, not letting it go when somebody confesses for a crime. We often hear of false confessions, and so that's an area that we need to address as citizens too. So thank you.
So to not be quite so credulous when we have the court document narrative, to engage our skepticism there. Thank you, Eva. And this gentleman right here, and then I'm going to go over there.
So as much as I love making fun of Reagan, I also know that President Clinton has contributed to mass incarceration through his 1994 three strikes provision. But really, my question is, can you speak to how prior offenders, once they're released, how they continue to pay for their crime even after they've served their time.
This is Murph's specialty.
All right.
So, yeah, that's a great question. So we call them collateral consequences. They're not really collateral. They're right up in your face. But when you are sentenced, you are not told about what these consequences are. And so they're collateral to your sentence. The judge never tells you what they are. Most public defenders will not tell you what they are. You won't hear that from the prosecutor. And so what are they? How do you keep paying? Well, one is you literally keep paying because you have legal financial obligations. Some are mandatory. So if you're arrested and you have to pay a DNA fee, there's a victim assessment fee that everybody has to pay, that you will pay when you get out, that accrues interest at 12%. You will also not be qualified to do certain professions. There's over 90 professions where either you're prohibited from doing those professions or it's discretionary whether or not you can get a license in that profession. So that's problematic. I think it's 80 to 90% of employers will look at your criminal record to decide whether or not you're a qualified applicant, whether or not your crime has anything to do with the job. Same with housing providers, that same thing will happen. It can affect your credit report. Your conviction will be on your credit report. So people who are reviewing your credit will be able to see that. You may owe extra child support that because you weren't able to pay while you were in prison, so you have to get caught up on your child support. That is also very and really difficult. You may lose your kids while you're in prison. You may not have gotten notice that your kids were going to be taken away from you, or your kids may have been adopted out, and you will not have notice about that. So you will have to deal with trying to reunite with your family. If you want to go and live with your grandma or your mom or your wife or your husband, if they're living in public housing or even in a private landlord, you may not be able to go and live with them. You may have to live somewhere else where a landlord will actually accept you. So your family will now have to pay for two units rather than just one unit. And there are hundreds of more. You may have lost your driver's license and not be able to get it back. There are certain educational loans that you will no longer qualify for because you are out. If you're in prison, you... and immigration consequences. So there's all kinds. And you may, even if your charges have been deferred or dismissed, you did everything you said you were going to do, say for a DUI, you may never be able to go to Canada again.
I'm going to get to a question here, but I think I might have a follow-up, which is of all those things that you listed, it sounds like a lot or maybe all of them might if they were remedied, might perhaps make someone more self-sufficient. So of all those things that could be remedied, why is something that is popularly remedied voting? Why is it often addressed that, now you can vote?
Right.
Out of all those things that you listed, why is something that has been decided, now felons can do this, is voting?
Yeah, I think because there was... The legislator did not see that as controversial at all. Like, most people who have felonies think they can't vote, and so it's made some difference. People are now have the vote and can vote if they want to, but it wasn't that controversial. Legislators weren't afraid, so it wasn't about fear and it wasn't about punishment, and so they weren't like, we need to do that. There's other states that do it. It wasn't that difficult, actually, to pass that. There was bipartisan support, and then everybody could go home and say, well, we've done something on criminal justice. We're one of the few states that allow people who have a felon who meet certain criteria can vote. Done.
All right. And this gentleman here, I will hold the microphone for you because I think it might get tricky.
Okay. I have a question, but before I ask it, I just wanted to say to the fellow who was asking what to do and what's the lowest hanging fruit, registering to vote and voting for people who are for sentencing reform is the lowest hanging fruit. If you've lived here for 30 days, there's an election coming up, just do it. But so my question is about juvenile sentencing, and as horrible, my question is really not so much about the most horrible cases with 14-year-olds getting sentenced to 20 years, but the whole system of juvenile sentencing and so-called juvenile reform. And if you could just talk about what's the situation now with sentencing juveniles to prison time?
I'll take a stab at it. I mean, it depends what jurisdiction you're in and what state you're in. So I think things are getting better here in King County in terms of the prosecutor's office is supporting a lot of reforms aimed at trying to keep a lot of juveniles out of the system altogether. You definitely can see progress in some places, but it really varies state to state and county to county. So it's hard. It's a really uneven landscape at this point. Some of the biggest questions are, well, first of all, how do they respond? How ready are they to use incarceration as a penalty for kind of middle to low level offenses? And that's where you see a lot of variation. And then the other thing that really matters is what's the age at which they are held accountable in the adult system as opposed to in the juvenile system. And that was something that a lot of states moved that age back in the 90s, so that in some states, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think even like 12-year-olds, 11-year-olds have been held accountable in the adult system in some places. So you see a lot of variation on that. Some states are edging it up a little bit, but even here in King County, which I think is one of the more progressive places, if it's considered to be a violent offense at a certain age, I think it's 16. You go into the adult system automatically. So even here, you know, there's work to be done on that, I think.
Yeah, that's called auto decline. One of the things that Washington has done well is we have closed many of our juvenile facilities, and we have one of the lowest actual incarceration rates for juveniles. We've done really well, but now the Department of Corrections wants to take one of those closed juvenile facilities and open it and rehab it for adult prisoners. And so the juvenile rates of incarceration are going down, and we're one of the few states where incarcerations for adults are going up. And for women in particular, the incarceration rates for women are skyrocketing. Right now, they don't have enough room in our prison system in Washington, and so they're taking women prisoners and housing them at the Yakima Jail, where there's very little services, very far away from some of their families. But we do have some really good services for juveniles across the state. So it's not terrible, but there is a lot more work we could do around juveniles. And kids are easier on the legislative front. People care about kids and think that kids can change. And the other thing that's really changed and why we've been able to make so much progress around juveniles and even on the intractable issues of horrible crimes that children have committed is because of brain science. So we've partnered a lot with the University of Washington and doctors and neurologists who say kids' brains are different. So until, especially males, until you are 25 or 26, and for some young men, even 29, your judgment, the part of your brain that uses judgment, is not fully formed. And it's different, and it's based somewhat on genetics. And so kids can't, people who are parents know that teenagers do not make good decisions all the time. And so the legislator and other lawmakers and advocates have really focused on this, and it's made a huge difference because we have science to show this. And so there's this sort of innocent quality about children that have make it easier to achieve reform.
I worry about the long-term implications for adults of that line of argument, because it makes it seem like, well, but then if you're past a certain age, you know, as if there's some kind of line there. So that's my only concern about that strategy.
I have been a teenager. I have made poor decisions. I've been a young adult and made poor decisions. Who has something they want to say or ask? I'm gonna pick on Sean for a second here. What is the work that you're doing these days that's prison related?
I'm on the board of Yoga Behind Bars, so we're bringing yoga instruction and meditation into prisons for men, women, and teens in the state. And, you know, you can't talk about it for 2 seconds without getting into equity and all the reasons why people are in prison who are in prison. And so it's a little bit like a water pistol in a war zone on the surface, you know. But that's the work we're doing. That's what I'm involved in.
Did you have skeptics in your life who said, why get to know prisoners?
Oh yeah, I'm one. Yeah, I mean, I'm very in my life. You know, but I've been out to I've been on site. I'm not teaching, but I mean, I've been to facilities, and that, you know, it's like you're only one bad decision. You know, I mean, I grew up a affluent white kid. I mean, if that hadn't been my lottery number, all the I did as a kid, I could easily have gone to jail. So
I think folks are doing their own calculation probably in their heads right now, like, dumb thing I did that could have landed me in jail, yet somehow I'm not there. So
Let's all do that calculation. Yes. Hello.
Hi. So that leads really perfectly into the issue that I was going to bring up, which is that, you know, just looking around the room and kind of the audience that's here for this within Seattle, and also, you know, I think mostly this is a friendly audience. This is people who already are aware of this on some level, and those questions about what can we do about it and how can we reach people who aren't so aware are really interesting. But I also was hoping that you could speak to, you know, as terrible as the system is, it is exponentially worse if you're a person of color, and how disproportionately people of color are arrested and prosecuted and incarcerated and sentenced. If you could just speak to that.
Sure. Yeah. The other statistic that Brian Stevenson said, and there are other ways to capture this, but the BJS, which is the Bureau of Justice Statistics, projects that one in six Latino boys born today will spend time in prison, and one in three black boys born today will spend time in prison. I think the figure for white males is something like one in 22 or something. So, I mean, yeah, I think the rates of incarceration for African Americans are about 7 times higher than for whites. And so that's bad enough, right? But it's all the things that Murph was talking about too, that then spill out and disproportionately affect families of color, communities of color, and so forth and so on. And it's so integrally tied up with class as well. It's hard to separate the two, but it's very, very clearly having a very disproportionate impact on communities and people of color.
And in our state, Native Americans are hugely overrepresented, and it's not like that in some other places, but for Washington, it's a huge problem. It's 2 or 3 times the rates of incarceration, and most studies show that mainly the crime rate or the engaging in criminal behavior is similar across races with some exceptions.
I see a question back there. I'm going to make my way over to you. I was on Facebook the other day, and when the toll thing was coming out, the first day of tolls on 405, and this Facebook friend of mine had this post about how he had been pulled over wrongly on a on-ramp, and got into an argument with the cop and won the argument and safely drove away, and in fact sped driving 70 to work. And I was like, I didn't know that person was white. what advice do you give to people of color interacting with law enforcement? Would you advise them to argue with the cop over a ticket or something?
No.
Okay.
No, in fact, I have another attorney in my office who's a black man, and he hands out these cards to people that say, do not talk, always ask for a lawyer, and basically what your rights are and what you should do. Keep your hands at your side, no sudden moves, all of those things. And we have lots of conversations about how young men are taught that in his community, and white men are not necessarily taught those kinds of things, and the different experiences in those different communities, it's amazing. It's this amazing cultural gap that we don't see.
And I have this gentleman right here who's ready with his comment or question.
Can I hold our just? Hi. Kind of speaking about expanding the scope of mass incarceration, I kind of want to get your opinion on the mass incarceration of immigrants, particularly with the detention center in Tacoma, in the family detention centers in Texas, and how that has increased so much, especially with ICE being, I think, probably the largest police force in the United States, at least the most funded. And can you speak about connecting, I would guess, like Michelle Alexander's notion of the Jim Crow and connecting it to what we're doing to immigrants right now?
Tackle the first part. I mean, so the statistics that you routinely hear in talks on mass incarceration, there's 2.2 million people incarcerated in the United States. That does not include people in those detention facilities that the question was referring to. And I think that's a really important point. The other thing that I think is really significant about those facilities, well, there's a lot of things. Conditions tend to be pretty poor. And relatedly, they are much more likely to be privately owned and operated than regular prisons, which means that that whole question about the profit motive and the incentive to cut costs at every corner and so forth is even more pronounced, I think, in that part of the detention apparatus. So I think it's a really important issue. In terms of the connections, until recently in many jurisdictions, there was kind of like a pipeline from jails to detention facilities because I'm sure I won't say too much about it because I'm sure many of you are familiar with it, but basically jails were doing screening to identify non-citizens. That information was being communicated to ICE. ICE would come into the jails and pick people up and take them straight to detention facilities. There have been some changes in the legal landscape, maybe Murph could speak to that, that have made it so that is not happening in as many jurisdictions, and it's not happening here in King County, but it's still happening in some places. So the pipeline's kind of weakened, but still exists in some places.
Yeah, in King County, I think last year they passed a law that said they would no longer refer people to detention, and they've done that in other counties across the state, but not in all states. And many people who are in detention haven't committed a violent crime or any crime except illegally crossing the border, and so that's their crime. And many people in detention are eligible for refugee status and are refugees and have suffered horrible torture and horrible things happening to them and are now locked up. So it's problematic. There isn't, I don't know of an easy way to address it. There has been a hunger strike in the detention facility, and what they did is they put all the hunger strikers in solitary confinement to try to break that movement. And so we represented the hunger strikers and got them out of solitary confinement. But that doesn't get them out of detention. And many people speak English as a second language and don't have an attorney to represent them in their deportation hearings. And many kids don't have attorneys to represent them in the deportation hearings. And so it's a huge problem. And even under the Obama administration, the number of deportations, the number of people in detention centers has, I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but they've skyrocketed. They've greatly increased.
Just one last thing on that. I think for people who are relatively young, it seems like this is the way it's always been. How could you do it differently? But I think it's important to note that until maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago, the sort of norm was to have people with outstanding claims to refugee status or immigration issues. Those would be adjudicated while they were in the community, as long as there was no indication that anybody posed a threat to public safety. That was the norm. And what's changed is now the norm is for people, including children, to be kept detained behind bars. And so that's been the sea change that's created this huge apparatus of these detention facilities.
Hi, I have a little bit of a follow-up to that, and I know you've kind of touched on this a little bit, but it seems that the theme that we're hearing here is a lot about bias that is coming across by these judges or by the people and how sentencing comes down, how people are being incarcerated. And I know that there is a separation between what the federal government can do, what the states can do, and what the local governments can do, but can you speak to any sort of potential changes that can come from this that we can do or that is coming that can somehow target the bias that is coming from, you know, a judge that just has it out for, you know, a race or a person for whatever reason, and how we can target this issue.
Well, I think there's some stuff that's happening right now. There's a group called the Minority and Justice Commission, and the chair of that, how many of you have heard of Justice Yu? Justice Yu is an amazing woman. She's a Supreme Court justice and is the first, I think, Latina, lesbian woman of also Asian descent to be a Supreme Court justice. And she's been working on these issues since she was a King County court judge and trying to educate the judiciary around it. So there has been some progress on that. The biggest, largest progress has been around implicit bias. So there's, how many people are familiar with implicit bias or unconscious bias? Has anyone taken an IAT, an implicit? A few people, so I highly recommend it. Go to the Harvard Implicit Association test, Google it, and take the test. And some sociologists, and it's pretty clear that this is correct. Almost all the studies agree that there's something in our minds that leads us to treat people differently, even though we don't intend to do so. And so we've made progress around that with judges by having them take these tests, by doing education around it. And there have been some recent court decisions that have recognized this implicit bias in Washington. The state Supreme Court said a few years ago that prosecutors can have implicit bias. And if even good people discriminate is what they said in the court opinion. So judges are getting educated, and there are still people who discriminate with horrible animus. And there was a recent decision at the U.S. Supreme Court around housing and whether or not, it's kind of a complicated legal theory, but whether or not there's this theory called disparate impact. Has anybody ever heard about that case? A few people. So there's two ways that you can get into trouble if you're a housing provider or real estate, and one is by treating people of different races differently. So in Seattle, they did a study, and they found that I think almost 60% of the landlords that they tested would, for example, ask a black applicant and charge them to do a criminal history run, but not on a white applicant. So that's explicit. That's illegal. Well, what if that same landlord tests everyone, does a criminal background check on everyone? Is that still legal? Well, maybe, except if that landlord has a provision that says no felonies. And why? Because that neutral policy has a disparate or discriminatory effect on black men, for example, because black men are more likely to have a criminal record than are white men. So the Supreme Court said that there has been this huge movement to say that doesn't exist under the Fair Housing Law. And Justice Kennedy said, no, we need to get at this hidden animus. And one way to do that is to say these policies may be neutral on their face, but they have this discriminatory impact on protected classes.
Sir.
Hi. You mentioned briefly detention centers being privately owned, and I was hoping you could speak a little bit more to the role of private prison corporations and the extent of their influence on legislative processes, and whether more publicity about their activities would help counteract that. Thank you.
So I'm not an expert on this, but from what I've read, the corporate interests in detention they're definitely more pronounced in the immigration area than in the regular prison context, which is not to say that in some states they aren't important actors. They are. But overall, I think it's still under 10% of all prisons that are privately owned and operated. I sometimes feel like that gets a bit of an overplay because I think the policies go much deeper than that. Clearly, it's a factor, but it certainly wasn't what gave rise to the mass incarceration in the first place. I think how much it matters depends on what state you're in to a large extent. That there are other interest groups that can be really powerful, though, too. And like so in California, the Prisoners Guards Union have been, you know, hugely influential. But it seems to really vary state to state. And so I think the answer is you kind of have to figure out what's going on in your state. In Washington State, I don't think private prisons are big actors here.
No, the private prisons aren't big actors. DOC recently said, we're too overcrowded. We can't get the legislator to fund a new prison. So they contracted with a private prison in Michigan. So that's happening. I think one of the big issues is the other kinds of correctional lobbyists, like people that provide the breathalyzers and people that build the prisons and people that provide the food services and all those, have huge amounts of money. And what they do is they give money for people to go to these conferences, and they provide all these meals and all these fancy parties, and they give all this money to this industry, to legislators, and it's sort of not tracked because it's not campaign contributions, but it's millions and millions of dollars across the United States that goes into lobbying that's not lobbying.
My question was essentially the same, but who all is benefiting from mass incarceration? So anyone beyond who you just listed?
Well, yeah, I think lots of people benefit. Prison guards benefit, prison unions benefit, communities, particularly rural white communities, benefit because the factories have gone and now they have a prison. And so there was a lot of competition to build prisons, particularly supermaxes, because they need more guards or they need provide more jobs. And so those communities benefit. I think prosecutors benefit. Huge more number of prosecutors, court reporters, there's a whole system that we have that Michelle Alexander, how many people have read the new Jim Crow? quite a few. I recommend it if you're really interested. It's a great book, and she talks about these social workers and me. You know, do I benefit from mass incarceration? I ask myself a lot about that. I'm trying to dismantle it, but there is this sort of industry where people benefit, and they perpetuate it, sometimes knowingly and sometimes not knowingly, but that's a really good point.
If I just can add one wrinkle to that, some of the new research coming out done by mostly geographers about the impact of having a prison in rural communities are showing that the benefits actually evaporate pretty fast, and it's complicated economically, but a lot of times the jobs actually don't go to people who live in that community, they go to others, and then and for complicated reasons, the local community often doesn't benefit and does get a lot of environmental pollution and other kinds of problems. This is important just because if we're ever trying to communicate and work with rural communities on these issues, it might be helpful for them to know that, in fact, they don't benefit as much as it might seem like they would at first glance.
So actually, I have a follow-up question to that. So is it economically feasible to cut down or try to dismantle the system? What would it do to the economy if all these prisons start to shut down?
I mean, I think that the goal would be to create new jobs, right? To help create staff positions for people to help transition out of prison. I mean, there's so much work that could be done to dismantle the system that could be a job creation project in and of itself. I think a lot of those jobs could be for former prisoners, for example, dedicated in that way. So I think there's a lot of like public works stuff that could happen that could replace some of those jobs in that happy scenario you described. Yeah.
In that private prison that is going to be opened in Michigan, the first coverage I saw of it before we covered it was from a TV station in Michigan, and it was totally written as a job creation story. Yeah, it was very interesting to see the difference between their coverage and ours. Yes.
So we talk about drug reform a lot, but what treatment do you propose for those who are physically and sexually violent while simultaneously providing relief for those who have survived those crimes?
Go ahead. That's a really hard question. And so there's different studies that show whether or not you can actually treat people. One of the things I like to think about is I think the studies are 1 in 3 women have been sexually assaulted or sexually abused as children, and not all of those, mostly men, are in prison or in jail. So there are those people who do those crimes who are walking among us. Many of them are middle-income white males. And so the question is, most of those folks who commit those crimes, there's a very small percentage of those who are committing the rapes that we think about. So they're not the man who's going to grab you in the parking lot. The majority of cases are either date rape or family violence that happens, and violence that happens within families, like domestic violence. So that's one issue, is dealing with family violence, dealing with incest, and dealing with date rape. So those things need to be dealt with, I think, in a social way, in a cultural way that we don't talk about, and we need to talk about it, and we need to provide services and treatment for those families. And the question is, does that dad, does that uncle, does it serve that low-income family well to have that provider put in prison for a really long time when his white, wealthier counterpart never has any consequences? And I think this really came to light when it was the family with the 19 children, and that the older brother who had done that and had been in the community for a really long time doing good things. And it's a really difficult moral question. Do we punish him and send him to jail and have his family not have that source of income or not have him contribute to society? Is it better to isolate him and put him away, or is it better to treat him in the community? I don't know. I think it's difficult. And then in many poor communities and poor communities of color, the violence is within that community. And so is the community better by locking people up and punishing them? I don't think so. And I really think there are some studies that show that kids who, and it's crazy, but kids who are in quality preschools, and not just quality preschools, but quality diverse preschools, do much better and have less violence and less issues. So it doesn't. So yeah, and I love what the mayor is doing around preschool and what the city council has tried to do. But almost all of the preschools that got the grant are in low-income neighborhoods. And so what I think we really need are to increase communities of opportunity. That's sort of a catchword, and just one sort of thing, I really like maps, and there's these maps that show the opportunities that are available in King County, and they're in the darker the brown, the better the opportunities are. And there's a line right across the ship canal of opportunity. It's really fascinating and sad at the same time. So I think there's a lot we can do. I think that there are some people who are sociopaths who cannot, I think there are some people who are dangerous. The number of and percentage of those people are relatively small, and those people do need to be removed. And there's some people that I think need to be removed for a very small amount of time. I think Catherine will know more about this, but there's some studies that show that after a certain amount of time, punishment has no value at all. Is it? What are the numbers are? I think it's 5 years. After 5 years, all it is punishment. It doesn't have any helpful benefit at all. In fact, it makes the person more dangerous in some cases. So.
I have a slightly different angle on the question. I'm not sure exactly what you were getting at, but I mentioned previously that I was working on a radio documentary telling the story of Jeff Coates, the guy who was sentenced to adult prison at age 14. We're starting another one, and the theme that we're exploring is whether or not victims are served by sentencing people to very long prison sentences. And the first story that we captured on tape was a story of a woman whose brother was a victim of the first school shooting in Washington State. I don't know if it was, I think, 88 or 89, something like that. And this, I think, 14-year-old kid shot and killed two other students and a teacher. And the woman that we spoke with was, you know, just incredibly eloquent in her description of how poorly served her family was by the prosecution of this kid, how they were sort of almost berated by the prosecution to play a certain role as the victims. The prosecution felt that they should be clamoring for more punishment, and that isn't how they felt, because it was clear to them that the shooter was a mentally ill child who needed help. So, and then other victims had different kinds of experiences. The net result was nobody, you know, the shooter got a life sentence. Did that help anybody? No, right? And so, and it's interesting because the shooter in that case is potentially coming up for resentencing because he was a child at the time he was sentenced, and there have been some Supreme Court decisions around that. But I think for me what that tells us is that we have to think more creatively about how to actually meet victims' needs, and not to assume that the longer the sentence for the perpetrator, the better off the victim is. That if you actually talk to a lot of victims, that's not what they say they need or want. It may be a piece of it for some, but for some it's not. The other thing I hear a lot about in my work at the prison is how desperately a lot of the inmates want to make amends. They are not, the rules are structured so that they are not allowed to contact their victims, and that's understandable. But even when the victim seeks it out, the DOC actually discourages contact. In the few cases that I'm aware of where that's broken down and the victim and the perpetrator were actually able to get together and talk, it's been amazingly transformative for both, for everyone, and very, very powerful. So that kind of gets you into the whole restorative justice way of thinking about things. So I think there's a lot of fruitful, you know, thought that could be done there to unearth some of those possibilities.
I know somebody has a question, something they've been sitting on. Here we have this gal over here.
Yeah, David Brooks in the New York Times just wrote a piece, and he was talking about how a lot of the issues you guys hit on, it's not really drugs, it's not really, you know, long-term offenses are a big problem. But he also said the prosecutors often are trying to make careers based off of it, or they have their own biases. How do we deal with prosecutors in small towns like John Krakauer in Missoula? The prosecutor in that town was atrocious. Like, if people don't put, you know, by their votes, don't put good prosecutors in office, like, how do we deal with that? Just the aggressive culture of the prosecutor.
Are there any prosecutors in the audience? Anybody?
Nobody's copping to it.
That is a really hard question, because I think the prosecutor's role has really changed. I think many people go into prosecution because they want to put the bad guys away and they want to keep their community safe. And so when I was in law school, people had this really sense of protecting the community and being really helpful and being of service as being a prosecutor, protecting the public good. And that's not really what happens at all. And I also think I haven't worked very much in small towns, and so I don't know what happens. I know that a lot of people that I work with who were arrested and jailed in small towns have much higher fees and fines than they do, and really weird fines. Like, one guy had to pay $6,000 to the prosecutor's favorite DUI charity And so, yeah, that's not really legal. But and there, this other thing that happens is everybody knows each other, and so it also makes it really, really, really difficult. And there isn't also a lot of training. There's not education, and the prosecutors can be awful, but the public defenders are also underpaid and not well trained, and sometimes. I love public defenders, but in some small towns, we've participated in some lawsuits against public defense because it's been so terrible. And how do we try to remedy that as a state? Well, we increase the fines and fees on the people who use the system, and rather than increasing funding. So funding is a huge problem. And I don't know what you do that. I love that book. The Missoula book is wonderful. I highly recommend it. And what happens in some cases, it's happening in Seattle, the Department of Justice comes in and says, you have to fix that problem. It came in Missoula and did that. It came into Seattle and said, we have to fix our police department. It's investigating in Snohomish County where people keep dying in their jail. One young man was 20, was he 19? I think he was 19, and his mom said, you need to turn yourself in. He had a warrant out for a small amount of marijuana. He had a food allergy. He said, I can't have any milk. They said, okay. They gave him a pancake. He said, does it have milk in it? They said no, and he ate it and died. 19 years old. And so do we need to... So he was basically sentenced to death for marijuana. And so it's a huge problem, and the federal government can come in. I don't think there's an easy answer for that. But it's a really good question.
Just also remember they are elected officials.
Let's see, we got my man back here. Just going to do a couple more questions here. So if you got one, bust it up.
Thank you. Hello again. You mentioned briefly the LEAD program as being helpful with seriously mentally ill prisoners. I understand that especially schizophrenia and bipolar affective disorder represent as much as 17% of prison populations, but around 1.5% in the general population. Do you see any benefit to in-house, in-prison treatment programs? Are those underway? And if they are they efficacious? Or should we be looking at more at diversions like mental health courts?
Most of the mental health programs in prison are horrible. They're not very good. In my experience, a psychiatrist comes and says, do you want to kill yourself? You say yes or no. There's no real privacy. It's not like you sit down in a private office and have this sort of interactive experience. That's not what mental health treatment is. And usually you're put in solitary confinement as part of that process. DRW, Disability Rights Washington, has done some lawsuits and some working with DOC to try to change that, and having special units where people can actually get care. But giving care for someone who's mentally ill in prison it just doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. And so what happens is mostly people get medicated. And it's really sad. So no, I don't think it can be done effectively. I don't think mental health care can be done effectively in prison. And I don't think it can be done effectively in jail. In fact, there was just a man a few weeks ago who hung himself in the Franklin County jail and wasn't well screened for maybe he was or maybe he wasn't, but there's issues about. So two things. One is you can be a doctor or other kind of medical profession in prison in Washington and not be licensed. Like, people who are bad doctors can work in prisons. So that's permitted. And so I think that it's hard to maintain quality staff in our prisons. And that's, so if you do get some treatment, it's probably not top of the line care.
Where's Phyllis? Can I just riff on that a little bit?
Oh, yes, please.
Okay, so part of what Murph's describing is a funding situation, right? There would be other issues, but one of the problems is there isn't enough funding to fund quality care in prisons. And I just want to tie that back to my earlier plug about long-term sentences. So what we have in the nation and in Washington State is an elderly prison population. So the number of people people age faster in prison than they do on the outside. So the number of people who are living in prison as older folks has skyrocketed. This is very expensive, and it's forcing prisons to cut back on other things like mental health care for everyone.
And I think so all of these things are kind of connected. One out of nine inmates in the United States is serving a life sentence. So the demographic projections are for just ballooning and skyrocketing costs. But legislatures don't want to spend more. They want to spend less. And so what we see is the prison conditions deteriorating more and more. So I think this is another reason why the number problem has to be addressed, because conditions in prison will get worse as long as more and more people are going there for longer and longer periods of time. But I do think that lawmakers are aware of this problem of aging prisoners and are beginning to try to reckon with it. And so I think it's a way that if you do talk to legislators, it's something you can mention as, and it's a fiscal issue to a large extent. So there is some traction there potentially.
I think this is our last question.
So I think there are people out there that when they see crime rates drop in their community, they think it's attributed to mass incarceration. They think that people being put away is leading to less crime. What would you say to people who believe that?
So, I mean, it's a plausible theory, right? Because crime rates have been dropping since about 1990, and incarceration rates started to increase before that. But since 1990 on, if you look at the lines, they're moving in opposite directions. Incarceration's going up and crime's going down. So a lot of people make that inference. And there's a big debate, as you can imagine, among social scientists. But the debate seems to be around where in the range of 10 to 20%, what's the quantity of the crime drop that is attributable to the increase in incarceration? And the debate is between some people who say it's about 10% and other people say, no, it's 20%. But either way, it's a pretty small proportion of the crime drop is attributable to the rise in incarceration. But the other thing to keep in mind is even if it's 20%, that's in the short term. Those people come out. So you only get, eight out of nine come out. for the folks who are coming out, if they're coming out with less stable physical and mental health, et cetera, then in the long run, it could have a crime increasing effect.
Well, they just dropped some knowledge on you for about an hour and a half. It was excellent. So, we learned about what can we do? What's the low-hanging fruit? Write to lawmakers, learn about some of these issues, learn about sentence length, and write in about that if that's something that grabs you. The number of crimes that are felonies, juvenile justice, restorative justice, and justice in rural areas. And I even got a couple of ideas about if I have someone I care about in prison, which I do, maybe something I should look into is paying some of those fees before they accrue interest if they're in a state where the interest accrues. And we learned also about the different ways that people are kind of coached before they have encounters with law enforcement. I think that's valuable to know about if you didn't know about that before. What is one last takeaway you want to give us or remind us of?
I think for me, I teach at UW, and I usually just blather on in my classroom and have very little impact on my students over the years, it seems like. But recently, I've started showing clips that were recorded at a conference sponsored by the Concerned Lifers organization. So what they did is they had they had speakers who talked sort of like we've been talking, but then they also had a bunch of people get up and just tell their story. And I've been playing some of those clips in my classes, and the impact is amazing. And I think it goes back to that. We need to let people tell their stories, let their stories be heard, let them be seen as the human beings they are. And I think that's a really important first step. So if you're interested in seeing some of those stories, you can go to Vimeo and just Google Concerned Lifers Organization, or put in the search bar, Concerned Lifers Organization or Faces of Life, I think was what that series was called. You can also Google Anthony Wright and Art Longworth, who have some really eloquent talks that they give from the inside the prison, and sharing those, I think, has a really big impact on how people start thinking about these issues.
That's great. Murph?
Yeah, this is a huge topic. I think learn about your own privilege, educate yourself about the criminal justice system is hugely important. Think critically, and you all are here, so I assume that you're all critical thinkers, but that it's all connected. How we police leads to how we arrest, leads to how we judge and how we incarcerate and who gets arrested and who doesn't and who gets incarcerated and who doesn't. And changing one piece of that system can really have a huge impact. For example, in Cincinnati, it took a really long time. I think it took like 10 years, but they changed the way that they policed. And they may be going back to the old way, unfortunately, but they did this problem-solving policing, and their incarceration rate dipped profoundly. So it really is how we police matters, how we educate. Support your preschools if you can, support early childhood education, support everyone having a home, because the more people are housed, the more people have jobs, the more people have access to education, the safer we all are, and I think the happier we all are in communities. And just one last plug is there were some studies that showed that the number one recidivism reducer is post-secondary education in prisons and outside of prisons. People who have access to post-secondary education and achieve it are very, very likely to end up in prison or to recidivate. So support all of those things and keep thinking critically about these issues.
I'm going to take that bias test from Harvard, too. That's cool. All right. Thank you very much, Murph Eamon, Columbia Legal Services, Catherine Beckett, University of Washington.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It does help other listeners find us. This Humanities Washington Think and Drink featured Murph Eamon, a staff attorney with the Institutions Project at Columbia Legal Services, and Professor Catherine Beckett, who teaches in the Department of Sociology and the Law, Societies, and Justice Program at the University of Washington. Northwest News Network managing editor Phyllis Fletcher moderated the conversation. This event took place at Naked City Brewery and Tap House on September 29th, 2015. Thanks again to Anna Sophia Knauf for our recording. Tune in next week for another great talk. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.